What do you mean?
I was waiting for my computer to load up, and
well,
I was
like
Skype on my phone, so it was ringing through the phone, but I can't have to record with the phone, so I'm just like, oh, well.
No, usually I wait for you to call me. I was trying to change it up this week.
That's all right, everybody. Welcome to the show here at AmpCredit.com. There's a really soft opening. I have no energy left in life. Matt's going to take over. We're going to do this for exactly an hour. I'm going to be counting down so we don't go for like 2 hours as we typically do, because I won't shut up. So, Matt, take it away and lead us through this show.
All right, let's do it. We're going to go back in time, then current time, then into the future, per usual. This past weekend, UFC 203 took place live from the Quicken Loans Arena in Cleveland, Ohio. It was on September 10th. Attendance, I actually did some homework. I prepped for this. Attendance was 18,875 people for a total gate of $2.6 million. My inside sources tell me you were at the Quicken Loans Arena, Mike. Is that true?
I was, in fact, there. I counted every single seat there. My estimates were also $2.6 million using a combination of my eyesight plus StubHub, and that's exactly what I came out with also. So I think the Athletic Commission is being honest with us.
Well, in this case, anyway, so that's a good thing. Prior to this show, there were a couple hiccups. Ray Borg pulled out of his fight with Ian McCall, I think on maybe September 7th, a couple days prior, due to an illness. And then CB Dolloway was injured in an elevator accident shortly after, like, those ceremonial weigh-ins. Not the real weigh-ins, but the ones where the fans are there and they videotape it and all that, and air it live. So after that, he was in the elevator with a lot of different fighters, actually. Faber was in there, Verdum, Yancy Medeiros, even like Babalu and Justin Buchholz, Ray Safo. I think Brad Tavares was in there as well. A lot of fighters, probably like a dozen guys.
Was he in the one with Faber? Because there was more than one accident with an elevator over the weekend.
Yeah, I think this was all the same one. Medeiros was talking about it after his fight, and said they were all in there, and the elevator dropped from like the second floor down to the basement. Something snapped. I don't even know. I didn't know that was still possible in 2016 for an elevator to break that way. But there were a lot of guys in there. And the only guy who was hurt bad enough not to be able to fight was Dolloway, who, interestingly enough, was supposed to fight at 205 for, I believe, the first time in his career. So maybe if he was fighting at 185, the elevator wouldn't have snapped and he would have been okay.
That's pretty good. I like that.
The other thing with it, too, is what if it was up a couple more flights? Like, you could have had a lot of guys hurt. Not only would the show be a disaster and possibly canceled, but on top of that, it could have been a lot worse if it was, you know, another floor or two up.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you get that thing one more flight, maybe two more flights, and you're again, whether the show would have been canceled or not, the fight pass probably would have been gone. Most of the prelims, you probably would have been able to scrape together a pay-per-view, because I think the main eventers would have been okay, but it would have been, way, way, way back in the day, and a lot of modern fans don't realize this, but prior to about 2005, there was something known as the UFC curse, and it manifested itself in events like Kevin Randleman, just minutes before his fight on pay-per-view, slipping on some pipes in the backstage area and knocking himself out. I mean, that's the kind of weird stuff that used to happen, and this is kind of, you know, reminiscent of that. Luckily, only CB Dolloway got injured, and, I mean, I don't think too many people are always sad when a CB Dolloway fight doesn't happen, but honestly, with the number of fights that got canceled that night, they went from, like, you know, 13 or 14 or whatever it was to, I think, 10 or something. It was, like, I think maybe the shortest number, fewest number of fights I've ever actually seen on a UFC show in my entire life.
Yeah, I think it was 10, and I'm looking at it right now. So in the opener, we can start at the beginning and work our way up. I think most of the conversation's probably going to revolve around the multi-time world champion CM Punk, wrestling, pro wrestling champion, that is. But we'll start at the beginning. You were there. Maybe you can help us break some of these down, too. Yancy Medeiros defeated Sean Spencer with a rear naked choke in 49 seconds of the second round. That was the only fight on Fight Pass. Any thoughts on that one?
Medeiros looked good. I know he moved up from 55 to 70. Size-wise, it didn't look like he was giving up any size. Doesn't necessarily mean anything because he wasn't taking on necessarily a giant welterweight. But, I thought it was an even fight. Both guys went back and forth. They both did their thing. Medeiros just kind of had like a high kick that got blocked, if I recall correctly. And he used that to lead it to the finish. So, good on Yancy. He got the W, and there ain't a lot more to say about it besides that.
Okay, then the opener on Fox Sports 1 was Drew Dober defeating Jason Gonzalez. By knockout, it was a minute 45 into the first round. My take on it was Gonzalez was just a little overmatched. This was his first fight in the UFC. Dober's been around several years. Just looked like the better fighter all around and just was a step ahead of Gonzalez the whole minute 45.
It did come across as a veteran kind of overwhelming somebody who's new in the cage. Early on, Dober's just kind of pressing him. And Gonzalez, you could just tell, didn't have it. His timing and distance was off, and things just weren't quite right. I thought as the round kind of wore on, there were little moments where Gonzalez seemed to be kind of finding his rhythm. He was getting a little bit, and then he just got clipped with some just brutal, brutal punches and got dropped like a sack of potatoes.
Then we had Nick Lentz defeating Michael McBride by TKO in the second round, 4:17 in. This actually ended up being a catchweight fight. McBride was a last-minute replacement, so he weighed in at 158. I believe Lentz made weight at 155, but this was another match where it just kind of seemed like two guys at two different levels. McBride, his first fight in the UFC on short notice, really couldn't stop Lentz's takedowns and pretty much got dominated on the ground, I felt.
Yeah, he was on short notice. He said that he gassed as a result of that. It doesn't surprise me, particularly the way he was fighting. He was fighting Lentz on everything. Like every time Lentz was going for a takedown, they'd be in positions where I thought that McBride should maybe have tried to bail on defending things. Like Lentz was trying to kind of halfway get behind in what we call like a riding position, but McBride would still be trying to grab a leg and hold on for some sort of single leg like you would in amateur wrestling. But there was, I think, a time to kind of give up on that and maybe go to a different position and try to move and conserve some energy. But even if he had, it was still just pretty much Nick Lentz 101. Get in there, make it ugly, drag a guy down, smother him, act like glue with a blanketed glue on a blanket, I don't know, and beat a man up. Gluing a blanket to somebody is what I'm trying to say.
Is it a wet blanket?
No, because it would have to be dry for the glue to work.
No, but isn't the saying a wet blanket?
No, a wet blanket.
I've never heard of a... All right.
Well, a wet blanket is, like a downer. It's like somebody that ruins the party. I'm saying he wasn't just a blanket on top of somebody. He was a blanket that was glued to the man, really making it a tight, tight blanket.
I didn't know if that was some saying I had never heard of or one you just made up on the fly.
I obviously just made it up.
I like it. I'm going to steal that. I'm not going to steal that. It was a joke. All right,
you're
moving along.
Explain that one to everybody. No, what you see is you got the blanket. Then you glue the blanket to the person. And the people are going to look at you, why the hell would you glue a blanket to somebody? You'd be like, it's a saying. It's from the Midwest.
Yeah. Next fight on Fox Sports 1 was a middleweight fight between Brad Tavares and Kyle Magalhaes. Split decision in that one. Scores all over the place, really. 28-29, 30-27, 29-28 for Tavares. How'd you see that one going, cage side?
This is the fight that I thought kind of turned the show. Prior to this, the show was going along. You had a lot of finishes, knockouts, submissions. I'm like, okay, this fight was just awful. It was boring. When it was over, I didn't have a strong impression either way for either man, other than I thought that Tavares, I don't want to say clearly, but he won the third round pretty solidly. And for that alone, I mean, sure, give him the fight. It's not like they weren't fighting. They didn't pull an Overeem and try to run away. But it was still just the way they matched up, the way that they were going to, they both approached the fight. It was a lot of just kind of moments of boredom. And it's just, I wasn't impressed either way by either guy.
Yeah, I'm with you. They're not going to be doing big buys on pay-per-view anytime soon, that's for sure. Next up, in the main event of the Fox Sports 1 card, Betch Koheya defeated Jessica I by split decision 29-28, 28-29, 29-28. You know, it was what it was. It was all, I believe it was all standing. I don't think it ever really went to the ground at all. It could have gone either way. I mean, if you thought they were going to be striking the whole fight, you would think I would have the advantage with the height and reach, but she really didn't do a whole heck of a lot. My favorite part of this fight was Koheya after the fight celebrating like she just won the world championship by knockout, running around the cage, dancing, getting booed, not caring. For me, the post fight was the highlight.
Oh yeah. I mean, fight wise, it wasn't good. It was I on her bicycle running away and just trying to, land jabber. Stop barking. Each of the dogs has a bone. One of them's protecting us. I was just content to try to jab her way. It seemed to a victory. Koheya was more, I'm going to stand here and just, when you're close, I'm going to try to land a couple of shots here and there. Neither one deserved to win. Neither one deserved to lose. The post fight, I don't know. I watched some of this stuff on TV, and as always, the UFC's ability to mic a crowd is just awful because in person, the boos that came in for this were just thunderous, to use a cliche.
Yeah, I mean, did you watch the show on TV as well? Or
I watched some of it on TV.
Yeah, I mean, you could hear her getting booed. I mean, I heard it, no problem.
I mean, it was so loud that I could not hear what Rogan and Koheya were saying inside of the cage. Like, that's how loud it was. All I saw was Betch dancing and having fun. And, like, she's, like, half a heel, half not a heel. She's kind of got that mix there. And
it's almost like she was oblivious to it. Like, I don't know if she was trying to, like, draw more of it out of the crowd, like taunting them, or if she was just in her own world and didn't even know they were booing her.
I think it
was bizarre.
Yeah, and like they did not like it when she was like the way she celebrated. Yeah, again, you would have thought that she won a gold medal, a world championship, and a lottery all at the same time. It was like, holy cow, lady, you just squeaked out a decision and you're in Cleveland. Don't be too happy with your life.
Well, she could easily could have lost it on all three cards, 29-28. Yeah. I mean, it wasn't like the best part was, I mean, I know a lot of times they celebrate afterwards because they think it'll sway the judges or something. Like that's a theory fighters have. I always hear the cornerman yell, put your arms up, you know, that whole deal. So I thought it was some of that, but who knows? She is a unique individual.
Yeah. I will say that the crowd, after a while, her dancing actually turned the crowd, and they kind of cheered her at the very end as she started dancing right before she left the cage. I don't know if it was on TV or not, but it's like, this crowd is schizophrenic.
What happens to Jessica I? Is she done in the UFC, you think? She's lost five of her last six in the UFC.
I mean, she was like in the top 10 prior to this. So, I mean, how do you get rid of a top 10? By any realistic standards, sporting-wise, she's got to be gone. I think she goes to Invicta, wins a fight or two, always be on notice, and she'll be back, presuming she wins a couple. Because, like, all of her fights, she's kind of basically been in them. She's never, like, I don't really ever recall her losing bad. Like, she did well with Misha Tate. We kind of talked about it last week, where she's kind of game, but, you know, she was in her hometown, and she had a chance to win this fight, and she backpedaled. She tried to play it safe. And if you're going to give anybody the benefit of the doubt, she ain't Leonard Garcia, and Leonard Garcia is the only other person I've ever saw that got this many opportunities.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know what they do with her. I mean, sure, they can give her another fight. I mean, nowadays, I don't think people are paying that close attention. There's so many fighters and so many shows. How many people know she's even lost four straight or even know who she is for that matter? You know what I mean? It's not,
And that's
not
the thing.
Six,
like,
7 years ago.
It's like, you know, it's a double-edged sword. Nobody really knows her, so what's the point of keeping her around? I think they kept her around because they knew that this would you know, the hometown, that works, okay, so be it. And after that was done, what else is there?
Right. Okay, next up, we're moving on to the pay-per-view portion of the card. It opened with Jessica Andrade defeating Joanne Calderwood by submission with a guillotine in the first round, 4-3-8 in. This was interesting because I thought Andrade might try and, like, blitz Calderwood and just, you know, outstrike her right off the bat. And Calderwood kind of held her own on the feet, but then Andrade just repeatedly took Calderwood down and kind of beat her up on the ground, and then eventually grabbed a guillotine with 22 seconds left in the first.
Yeah, it really reminds you that as good as Andrade looked with her striking last time, she is a black belt in jiu-jitsu. She played the smart fight. I thought that of everybody that fought on the entire show, she far and away looked the most impressive because she took on, you know, a top 10 opponent and ran through her like it was absolutely nothing. Like, you watch that fight and there's no way you walk away thinking Calderwood's not even close to her level, and combine that with her last fight and, you know, the dearth of kind of quality opponents at 115 pounds. I mean, there's people, but, you know, Rose and Andrade and I don't know, there's some other Polish chick, I can't think of her name right now, and that's about it. So she's quickly made a name for herself in short order.
Yeah, I'd like to see her maybe get one more win at 115, and then, yeah, she'd be right up there for a title shot. She just seems stronger than everybody. I mean, I shouldn't say everybody else in the division because she's only had two fights, but she seems like a strong, powerful 115-pound fighter.
Especially when you compare her to what she looked like at 135. This isn't somebody that's like, oh, you know, she, you know, maybe she's on something or doing something different. Like, at 135, she looked kind of soft. And at 115, she looks ripped. Like, this looks like somebody that is getting down to the weight the right way. And in addition to just, you know, being strong as hell, I think she's also just in better shape than ever before to make that weight. And it's turning, you know, it's producing a really dangerous fighter.
Yeah, she's quicker, everything. I mean, even at 135, she was solid. I mean, she wasn't elite top five or anything, but she only had a couple losses at 135, I believe. I mean, she was over 500 in the UFC, 20 pounds heavier. And if you can make the weight 20 pounds less, why not?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Next up, Jimmy Rivera defeated Uriah Faber by unanimous decision, 30-27, 30-27, 30-27. It was kind of the way you would have guessed it would have gone, I think, personally. Rivera was just a little quicker, better on the feet, kept the distance. Faber really couldn't get inside enough to do much damage. There was a nasty eye poke in the third round. Rivera claimed after the fight he couldn't see out of his eye at all, and still Faber couldn't do anything. I don't want to say it's the end of the road for Faber, but is he ever going to be a top five sort of guy again at 135? I don't know at this point in his career.
I don't think so. I think that the fight showed a lot of the kind of the weaknesses that Faber's been more or less getting by and covering up, and that's that his wrestling just isn't there. And
right.
Striking wise, he's always going to be kind of game, but he just can't hang. I mean, it's not like Rivera really impressed me much either. He just knew how to throw a leg kick. And after all these years, nobody just ever showed Uriah how to check a leg kick, to the point where Rivera even said, I know he doesn't check leg kicks. Like, that's a really bad thing when all of your opponents publicly talk about your weaknesses and you don't correct them. To me, the story was,
you would have thought after that first Aldo fight, he would have fixed that.
You would think.
You know what I mean?
Like
oh my God, that fight. it's unbelievable.
It hurts, but checking leg kicks is basically as simple as raising your leg an inch or two and turning your shin towards the guy so they kick your shin. Like, it'll hurt, but it's a lot better than what happens to Faber. But again, to me, the most notable thing of all of this is Jimmy Rivera gets poked in the eye so bad that even after the fight, he still couldn't see. And yet somehow a doctor from an athletic commission didn't notice that a man could not see. I don't know what the point is of athletic commission doctors besides ignoring injuries and allowing other injuries later on to stop fights for no reason.
Yeah, the biggest loser on the show might have been the Ohio State Athletic Commission. Next up, where are we here? Oh, the only fight that anyone cares about on this show. I'm exaggerating, but for the most part. Mickey Gall defeated CM Punk by rear naked choke, 214 in the first round. Where do you even start here? There's so much.
Joe Rogan and his amazing, amazing honesty on TV that you never see from people.
Yeah, Rogan bashed Punk. I mean, for like anybody doesn't know what happened at this point, but Gall just totally obliterated Punk. Essentially walked through him, took him down immediately, and then just dominated him on the ground from mount to back control, and choked him out in 2 minutes. Got some good shots in too when he had Punk flattened out. What was your take cage side? Did anything you picked up during the fight that we might not have been able to see at home?
I've watched this fight a couple of times now at home just because I have 2 minutes to kill a lot. And in the fight, I mean, anybody wants to go, not that I'm Nostradamus here, but I think I broke this fight down exactly as it would happen. Oh, Mickey's going to double leg him, take him down, punch him, pass the guard, take the back, and choke him out. Like, this was textbook how you beat somebody. The only thing I saw live that maybe didn't come across on TV was I thought Punk looked like he was more – I just had the impression that he was enjoying the moment. Which is fine, except for you're in a cage fight, and most guys who really want to fight aren't, like, they enjoy the moment afterwards. In the moment, all they're thinking is, I want to rip this man's head off. And the way he came forward at Gall, I was right there. Like, he's coming right directly at me. Sometimes when you get cage side seats, they suck because you get blocked by a pillar. I had perfect center, right dead center. Nothing blocked my view. And I see this look on Punk's face, like, being mean. And, like, he's just cocking his right hand, like, using the most telegraphed, like, Rocky Balboa-style punch. And it's just like, are you serious? Because, like, anybody in the world would have seen that. My mother would have seen that coming. And Gall obviously just ducked under and took him down with the same amount of ease. We saw Punk get taken down like that over and over again on the hype show. Like, it was just amazing that he still just didn't have any somebody gets deep on you on a double like that, pinches your elbows and stuff like that, they're going to get a takedown usually, but Punk doesn't seem to have any fast twitch muscles or reaction skills, and it really just played out. And again, I didn't get the impression that this was a guy who cared about winning and losing, and that's a really bad habit to have. Like, I've been in fights or matches, and when I've lost, I've had matches where I've just gone out there and got smoked. I slipped. I did something dumb. I'm not happy afterwards. I might put on a happy face or something, but I'm not fun in games. I'm disappointed in myself. I'm on the ground for a bit. Unless it's, you know, I compete with somebody and they're truly at a different level and I just respect them for it. That's one thing, but Punk shouldn't have been thinking that way. Again, he just didn't seem like he was there to fight.
Yeah, I mean, to me, watching just his walkout and everything, he just seemed happy to be there. I think there was so much talk that he was never going to fight, he'd never get in the cage, he was always hurt, and that he felt like he accomplished something just by getting there. Like, that was enough, you know? Getting there and winning the fight would have been a bonus. I mean, and I'm just, hypothesizing there, but
no, you're
accurate. That was how he looked.
Yeah, and it's something that's just annoyed me to no end. The whole, you respect the guy for getting in there and fighting, and yes, there's that superficial level of it, but he fought in the UFC. And,
right.
And honestly, he didn't even fight. He could have trained a single day and done just as well. Like, and I'm not exaggerating that at all. There were just so many things missing, and I know I messaged you. We kind of gone back and forth after the open workouts, and I kept talking about how, like, the way he's taking the back, there's just little things that aren't clicking, and I'm like, these are things that shouldn't be happening if you've been training for a long time, and they all manifested themselves the way that Mickey mounted him. It wasn't even like some great, brilliant mount. It was just a knee slide over. And again, I in a real fight, yes, things are different. It's quicker, it's faster. Someone's, punching you. But I roll with black belts all the time, and they have a really difficult time doing a mount like that to me. They have to, they mount me sometimes, but it's from different positions. But this, the wherewithal to know, okay, this guy's going to probably do this. Maybe I want to catch the quarter guard, try to get the half guard. Punk didn't seem to know how to move. He didn't seem to have an answer for anything that was happening. And
yeah,
it was just defend, choke, get punched, defend, choke, get punched, get choked out. He wasn't trying to scoot his hips. He wasn't trying to break the hooks. It just seemed like he didn't know what he was doing.
Yeah, I mean, there's two aspects of it for me. One is maybe Punk just would have never made it. And if he started training when he was 16, like Mickey Gall, maybe he never would have made it. There's thousands and thousands of guys and girls who train for years and end up being, 2-5 and never fight again. And that's their MMA career. That's what happens to most people when they start young. Imagine starting at 35 and having a year and a half training with a litany of injuries. The chances of being good are 1,000 times less than the average person starting out when they're 16. Like, the likelihood of him being successful in the UFC was pretty 0.00000001%. It just wasn't going to happen.
And especially given that, again, it's not that so he had no combat sports background. He had no sports background. As far as I'm aware, this was the first time in his entire life he's ever actually competed at something. Everything he ever heard, I don't think he ever played baseball or football growing up or basketball. Like, he's been, doing pro wrestling since he was like a teenager. He's never been in an athletic competition. And there's a mentality that people have to develop. And I say this as somebody that has struggled with it over the years. I have to learn how to do it. And I do much better in competitions when I can kind of remove that aggressive aspect, the competitive aspect, and kind of suck an opponent into, this feels like a sparring session type of deal, which you saw a lot of fights like that on the card. The semi-main event was like that. But just, he doesn't know how to fight. I mean, that's just, he's not a fighter. I don't think he's a born fighter. He's definitely not a born athlete. And he had no real training. I mean, I'm 33, and I've been training basically, with the exception of here and there, the past couple of months when I got injured, since I was 25. And, right. That's 8 years, and I truly believe I could beat CM Punk in a fight right now today, and I'm out of shape. And like, I'm not exaggerating. I don't mean right. I don't mean that to be like I'm a big tough guy so much as it is reality of how far he has to go.
Right. Yeah. No, I'm with you. It was ridiculous odds from the get go. It was just crazy. So here's the question: What's next for Punk? The word on the street is this show did somewhere between like 600 and 700,000 buys. I would attribute, maybe 400 or 500,000 of those to Punk. A show headlined by Stipe Miocic and Alistair Overeem's not doing more than 250,000 buys. It just isn't.
It would probably do, apparently, I think Miocic and Verdum did like 350.
I don't know.
So Yeah, but we talked about
it. I'd be curious to see what was on the undercard of that. I have to look back.
Vitor Belfort was on the undercard. I mean, it was a stronger
undercard. Was that the All-Brazil show?
Yeah.
With Cyborg.
It was a stronger card. But still, we kind of talked about it last. We were both kind of like, I was doing 500 and 750 just on the Who Knows with Punk, but more or less attributing about 300,000 to 400,000 pay-per-view buys to Punk. And
right.
You nailed it exactly on the head, so it's pretty much what we expected him to do, which is, I'm kind of surprised.
I just felt like there was a lot. I mean, I was kind of scoping out some, Facebook fan pages, that sort of thing, and looking online and trying to get a feel for what the vibe was. And a lot of people were talking about this fight. Like, I mean, I don't have a lot of friends, but the few I do have, we're talking about it and wanted to see what was going to happen. There's that freak show aspect that people like. The question is, will they pay for it? And in this case, it looks like they did. I mean, they're saying besides, UFC 200, Rousey shows, McGregor shows. This is the biggest show since Jones versus Cormier, the first one. And it's all Punk. I mean, you can't credit Miocic and you can't credit Overeem. They've never been draws. So the question is, did he bring in enough money and revenue for them to say, you know what, let's give him another shot because – you know what, there might still be enough people out there that want to see him fight again.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. I got a very strong impression live that this was much more of a pro wrestling crowd than I've ever seen in a UFC. And I've been to, I don't know how many UFCs live, and I have no idea. And people were doing the Ric Flair woo all night. when Punk came out, he got the second biggest reaction behind Stipe. People just went apeshit for him. Even when he lost, they were still kind of cheering him on. So, he was definitely, I think, to the crowd there, the number two guy. Whether he can do it again is a complete crapshoot. I think if he had shown anything in the fight.
Yeah.
But, I mean, he got smoked so bad.
Yeah.
And I know he did a lot of buys this time, but. If you bring him back, it's even more of a freak show because it's clear. You're just saying, well, we just want to watch this guy get beat up. Because I mean, again, unless you truly bring in somebody at my level to fight the guy, and at that point, it's not the UFC. I know Tom Lawler talked about this, and I thought he was absolutely correct when he said there is until almost basically CM Punk. Something special about saying you fought in the UFC. Like, sure. I was in the NFL. I was in the NBA. Like, these things matter. There's a reason why guys, when they get called up to the big leagues in baseball, it's even if they're only for a couple of days, and baseball is probably the best example because basically basketball, you're either in or out. Football, you're in or out. Most guys don't make this show at 30. But in baseball, you see these guys who are lifers in the minor leagues, and they get their call up, and maybe they play two games, get one pinch hit, but they get to say for the rest of their life, I played Major League Baseball. That's really cool. And the UFC has that. And the more that they do something like this, which again is a complete fluke. There's not going to be very many of these. There haven't been very many of these. The only two that really ever come to mind are James Toney and Hoist Gracie. They're the only real true freak shows where you watch it and you go, this is an embarrassment in advance.
I'm with you. I mean, part of me says, UFC is the most elite MMA brand in the world. It should be the best fighters in the world. But another part of me, it's like, it's cage fighting. Does it really matter? Is anything bad going to happen to the UFC or any of the other fighters if Punk fights again? Except they'll have more eyeballs on him.
Yeah, although, again, look to Japan and take the lessons of Japan. When you go to the freak show well too much, and it starts to dilute people. I mean, Japan had those huge rates. And again, the UFC is in Japan. They're not doing entire cards of freak shows. But it's easy to get sucked into it. I don't think it's a problem. The UFC's never done it. I don't think they will do it. Dana seemed pretty cut and dry there. I mean, they had to have known that he was going to do business for them. I'm sure they had an idea. And he still was like, I don't think he should be fighting here. And I think it all comes down to just how absolutely abysmal his performance was.
Right, but would they cut him and let him go to Bellator?
No, I don't think they cut him. I think that they keep him under contract, and they just say, if you want to fight, you can fight for RFA. You can fight for any of our Fight Pass promotions, basically, which is everybody but Bellator. If they do cut him, I know exactly what fight to make for Bellator.
Yeah.
There's one dream.
What's that?
Oh, I thought they, if the UFC had been able to pull it off, it would have been the greatest fight ever. I think the perfect fight for Punk is Royce Gracie.
Yeah, I remember you saying that.
It's a legend who isn't very good. And if there's a guy that can't take you down and you might be able to punch, it's Royce. Like, if you're Bellator, you get the chance. CM Punk versus Royce Gracie? Now that Kimbo's dead, you need some other freak to show. You know, they got to replace their freak shows. And CM Punk could be the next Kimbo, just worse.
But. They could even do Punk versus Kimbo Jr. Oh, Kimbo, they could. What the hell?
I don't even know what that guy's ever done. And he's probably beat Punk.
I think he's 1-0. He's got like one amateur fight. It was actually out in Western Mass. But, I mean, he would draw in Bellator. I don't see him cutting them and risking that. And if he really wants to fight again and he brought in millions of dollars, I know Dana, the night of the show, wasn't thrilled, but sometimes money talks. There's new owners. They're trying to make money. I wouldn't be surprised if he fought again.
The thing is, if he fights again, if they want to, you know, do that for just a purely a cash grab, it's got to be on pay-per-view again. If he fights on free TV, he doesn't make them any money.
Yeah, I mean, who knows what could they put him on Fox? When's that next Fox deal up? 27? It's up 2017, right? You know that they might be trying to get some good ratings on Fox, and you put him in the semi-main against I don't know who, another 1-0 fighter who's not very good. And yeah, it doesn't look good on TV, and it's not the product they usually put out. But what? There's 50 shows a year. Twice out of those 50, 600 fights. I mean, who cares? It's lighten up. All right. moving along. Mickey Gall, after the fight, called out Sage Northcutt. Got a pretty good promo, I thought. I feel like Gall came out of this looking like a star just from his entrance. You know, he came out to the Ooh Mickey song that he wanted to. Dana changed his mind, let him come out to that. He was styling his hair as he walked out to the cage. Just kind of came off like a potential star. Will he pan out? Who knows? He hasn't really fought anyone good, clearly, at this point. But one of the less experienced guys in the UFC who he wouldn't be obviously pretty competitive with is Sage Northcutt. Gall wanted him at 205, but Sage's dad says Sage can't fight. He has a staph infection. You think the Sage fight makes sense?
If you're Mickey Gall, it makes all the sense in the world. I message you, I go, I meant to ask him that question. I think if you're Mickey Gall, that is a brilliant fight to ask for. One, Sage isn't a welterweight, so you're going to have that advantage. Two, if you're looking for a guy on the UFC roster that's kind of at Gall's level, that's a pretty good guy to fight. It's somebody that who has trouble on the ground, who's got this big name, basically. And realistically, it's the level of the caliber of skill and fighter that Mickey Gall and Sage Northcutt should both be fighting. You know, they're both essentially early pros. And
absolutely.
Early pros shouldn't be fighting, you know, real top-level guys. Like, Mickey should not be fighting anybody that you've really heard of at welterweight. He's got a year or two at least before he gets there. Because, he's a brown belt. He's looked good. But he's not a freak jiu-jitsu guy. Like, he's 24 and a brown belt. That's very impressive. But the high, scary jiu-jitsu guys are 20 years old and black belts. Like, those are the guys you have to really go, oh, okay, this guy's it's a different level. Mickey's going to be, you know, a solid grinding type of fighter. Maybe he can make 155. I don't know. But in Sage, I mean, they basically said that they are kind of in for it. Dana likes it. It's a great fight. I think it has a lot of interest. The two guys from the Dana White Finding a Fighter show, and I think it's just, again, Mickey Gall, I interviewed him. He seemed like a very nice guy, but I think he's a lot more intelligent than people realize. Like, this is a guy with a plan. Everything he's doing, like, he's not a meathead. And I say that in the sense of he comes out a lot and he sounds very nice and humbled and he says things, but he's definitely planning his moves, and kudos to him for doing it. I mean, he planned his way into the UFC. He's planned his way into two easy victories. He's planning his way to maybe a third. Extend that contract. And hey, the guy made $30,000 for the night, which good for him.
Yeah. Speaking of pay, it came out that CM Punk's disclosure. The thing about the pay that drives me crazy is people look at the disclosed pay, you know, that they're declared by the commissions as what each fighter made, which isn't the case. There's, you know, pay-per-view points for main eventers and champions, and there's discretionary bonuses for two guys who had a barn burner of a fight. So the disclosed pay for Punk was $500,000, which I believe was the third most on the show. Guys like Gall are getting $30,000. Some guys are, I think Jason Gonzalez made like $10,000 losing on the undercard in his first fight. So Punk making $500,000 has upset like everybody online that follows MMA. And again, the question is, how do you define merit in combat sports? Is it just based on being a great fighter and winning fights, or is it based on what you draw and how many eyeballs you bring to the TV and how many asses you put in the seats? And bottom line is, it's more the latter than the former. Conor McGregor makes more money than everybody else, not because he's the best fighter of all time. It's because he's the biggest draw. I don't understand people being that bent out of shape about Punk making that money when, in fact, he probably even made more, like three, four, five fold, possibly.
And especially given that whatever he made, the UFC ain't stupid, they made more off of him than he made off of them. Like, they didn't go in the red for him. So he clearly has generated the revenue. It's just like Conor. Yes, some guys make money just by being really good. But they have a value in that they lend legitimacy and credibility to a promotion, like Cain Velasquez. Right. You know, although he kind of does okay with Mexicans until Trump gets elected and they can't buy pay-per-views anymore, because that's one of Trump's platforms. But all of us, the deplorables, whatever, I don't know. When I saw that with Punk, again, make whatever you can in life. Never, you know, never ever root for the business, the owner to keep the money. Because if it doesn't go to Punk, it's not going anywhere else. But
right.
That said, when I saw that kind of money, and assuming he makes more, but even if he only makes a $500K, some part of me is just like, really, Punk? Like, your whole Mr. I just want to do this, and I would have fought amateur and done this and blah, blah, blah. It's like, yeah, and then you took a $500,000 payday. Like, you got special treatment. You got, and again, he earned it, sure, but, and I wish I could find a quote, but I don't really give a shit to look it up, but I feel like Punk's the kind of guy that when he's in pro wrestling, if somebody had come in and gotten a slot ahead of him and made more money than him, he would have been pissed. He would have been,
He bitched about The Rock coming back.
Exactly. And he's no different than The Rock, except for The Rock made even more money for the company on a per capita basis and was The Rock. And, you know, you're a whiny, he's not even he looks like a vegan, but just, you know, you're a guy that did a lot of running, and then you thought you could be a cage fighter in 18 months.
I mean, there's some irony, though, in the whole thing. It's like people complain about fighter pay, then a guy gets paid and they're pissed. It's like, what, you want him to get paid $10,000? I mean, what?
Yep.
It's crazy. It's crazy. But I get that theory. He sucks. He shouldn't get paid. But that's not what the sport is. There's a prize fighting aspect to this where it's based on what you draw. Like, it's not just athletic merit based. It's part of the merit is the money you bring into the company. That's part of the sport, and it's like
for sure.
People don't get that.
And you know what?
It blows my mind.
If he had like a real low base salary and was getting points in the pay per view, and we didn't really know, I'd be fine because I'd be truly be getting paid what he brought in. But in theory, if this pay per view bombs, he still gets that $500,000.
Right.
And I mean, I just think that for again, it doesn't matter. Good for him. He got his money. He didn't take a dime away from anybody else. It's not like they looked at it and said, you know, we were going to give Travis Brown $500,000, but we gave it to Punk instead.
Right. If Punk brought in, let's just say, 300,000 buys, I think it's more than that personally, but let's just say it was 300,000 buys, that's $60 a head. That's $18 million brought in.
And that's $9 million the UFC gets.
Right. So 500,000 of 9 million that he brought in all on his own, that doesn't sound out of whack to me at all. UFC kept 8.5 million of that.
Yeah, he's basically getting about 10%. I mean, even if he only makes a 500,000, that's about 10% of what he actually generated. And I mean,
in other sports, that would be ludicrous. You know, a lot of major league sports, the NBA, that sort of thing, it's like a 50-50 split. Sometimes it's even more for the players, depending on the league.
Every major sport is basically around 50-50. There were times in the NBA until prior to the last lockout, NBA players were guaranteed 57%.
Right.
And that kind of actually screwed the league a little bit. It's seen. I have no idea. Although I guess there was a time there when it was tough to find guys to buy basketball teams, and then now they're being sold for $2 billion. The UFC is being sold for $4 billion. And the Los Angeles Rams, I just saw today, their value in Cincinnati was $1.2 billion. Now, just by moving to Los Angeles, their value is $2.5 billion.
I saw that. Yeah, it's wild.
Wow, St. Louis. Nobody cares about you, St. Louis. The only thing you're known for is shooting that poor black guy. That's all you've done. And LA did the same thing to Rodney King. So you're really bad, St. Louis. Plus you're Illinois' shit brother.
All right, we'll keep it moving here. We're going off the rails. Next up, we had Fabricio Werdum versus Travis Brown in a rematch.
No, hold on. It was Fabricio Werdum versus Travis Brown and the Athletic Commission.
Yeah, there was a lot going. We should back up a little bit. It's hard for me to say this, but I love this show in so many different ways. And this fight's one of the reasons. The fight itself was not good, but Werdum ended up winning the fight by unanimous decision, 29-28, 29-27, 30-27. So some screwy scores there. Werdum, there's a rumor that he broke his foot 3 weeks out from the fight. He looked really soft and not himself walking into the cage, I felt. But he opens up with this, like, running crazy sidekick, nails Brown right in the face, like rocks him. Like, I was like, oh, my God. I know Verdum's done it in the past. I know there's a pride fight. It might have been against Overeem where he did it. Like, I've seen it before. But it worked. What's that?
It worked.
Oh, I know. He clocked him like right on the chin. It was beautiful. But then it was like nothing else really happened the whole fight, except in the first round where Werdum threw, I think it was a right hand, and Brown kind of blocked it. But as he blocked it, his hand kind of banged into the side of his head and broke it. I think it was his pointer finger. And you could see the bone sticking out. Brown calls for like a timeout. And I think it was Gary Copeland, mini Brock Lesnar, tries to, like, stop the fight but only does it half-heartedly. And Werdum just rushes in, punches Brown, and then the ref steps in and stops it so Werdum can get his finger looked at. The doctor comes into the cage, looks at his finger, and tells him he's okay and to continue fighting. It was bizarre. It was bizarre. And then the fight went three rounds where Brown didn't do much, and Werdum was doing these, like, rolling axe kicks and, like, somersaults.
He did the Jushin Liger Kapo, not Kapo, whatever it is. It's like that rolling kick the Jushin Liger does. Like, what the? It was stupid.
It was so weird. It was not a good fight, but it was a bit of a spectacle. You have anything else about the fight? Because the post fight was almost as good as the fight itself.
Yeah. As far as the fight goes, the first round was fine. Verdum did drop him with a punch, took his back, almost got the choke, but didn't finish it. Obviously, the fight should have been stopped the moment Brown said, "Hey, my finger's broke." Like, that's submitting. You got injured by a legal strike. You don't get timeouts. Like, if he had backed away and circled and, like, popped it back in himself, so be it. He would have been a really tough dude. But, I have no idea. It was so weird. It was weird that Brown would signal that, because you would think as a fighter you would know that that's going to cause a fight to be stopped. It was even dumber that the referee and the doctor and the commissioners and everybody involved there let it happen. Personally, sitting cage side, I didn't know what happened. Like, the way they reacted, I assumed that Brown got his finger stuck in the glove funny.
That's how it looked immediately. Yeah.
So I'm like, okay, that's a legitimate reason. It hadn't occurred to me that he hurt his hand and needed some medical attention. Like, this isn't pride where, like, you get a cut and they stop it and they kind of try to put an end swell on it in the middle of a round. It was absurd. Verdum looked like crap. This is two fights in a row. He's looked like crap. I think that, whether it's enhanced testing or the fact that he's getting closer and closer to 40, or maybe he was injured, I don't know. But he did kick Edmund Tarverian in the side. So that makes him a fucking hero. I mean, goddamn, you fucking Armenian scumbag. You just cannot help. He cannot help. That guy has to be the single worst person in MMA. You've destroyed Ronda. You've destroyed Travis Brown. Everyone you touch sucks, and you're not good at your job. And then you talk shit to the former heavyweight champion of the world and get kicked on national pay-per-view.
Here's another fun part. I don't know how well you could hear it sitting cage side next to Ariel Helwani and all these other big stars, but could you hear Coach Edmund screaming at Brown in between rounds? He was like calling him an MF-er and kill this guy. It was like something out of like a 1980s like boxing movie.
Yeah, I did see that.
I thought he was going to slap Brown in the face. Like, he's like, fuck your finger. Like, it was crazy.
I heard some of that in between rounds when Brown was on the corner on his stool, and I'm just kind of like, I'm doing 1,000 things. I'm tweeting, I'm updating the site, I'm getting dumb pictures ready to post and all this crap. And, like, I'm kind of like halfway looking going, I don't hear advice. I just hear him, like, trying to fire Brown up. And it's like, I mean, Brown's career has definitely gone down a lot. It's not just Edmund, but let's blame the guy for ruining another fighter's career.
Yeah, it was something else. And then, like you said, after the fight, they were getting booed heavy again because the fight was pretty dull, besides the broken finger and the jumping kick to start it. But Verdum was like doing, the crying hand signals to the crowd. And I think that's what pissed Edmund off. And then Edmund started yelling at him for doing that. And that's kind of how it got going. I think a lot of people were blaming Edmund, but on TV, that was kind of how it looked like it happened. Edmund just started giving Verdum some shit for, you know, maybe he thought he was mocking Brown in his finger and crying. I don't know what Edmund thought, but he seems like a guy who's on the verge of, like, a serious breakdown.
Edmund?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I think every day of his life he's on the verge of a breakdown. I mean,
he's bankrupt. Ronda won't fight anymore. All his fighters are terrible.
Yeah. When I watched it on TV at home, Verdum, I mean, to me it looked like he was just mocking the crowd. Because he kind of was looking away at the crowd like, oh, you're boo-hooing. And he later said that he thought that the crowd was booing him because the people in Curitiba had booed Stipe and he thought it was just them getting back, which... I mean, it didn't occur to him that his performance sucked. That said, I thought that partially ripping on Cleveland, but there was a point in his speech when Verdum's talking like, a friend of mine just died 3 days ago and I'm dedicating this. And the crowd is booing louder. And I'm like, holy shit, dudes. Like, you don't have to cheer, but you can at least, like, usually when, like, the guy dedicates something to a dead friend, the crowd kind of goes, oh, okay, maybe he's a little bit of a nice guy. No, they just booed him even more.
Yeah, I mean, it got so bad they had to clear like all the cornermen out of the cage too, because it didn't get to the point where it was a brawl, but it was escalating pretty quick. So they cleared the cage.
Oh, there was half a dozen cops walk by me.
Yeah,
right during the promo, like I just see all these big cops walk by. I'm going, what the like? I've seen that before, like. You know, the UFC did that with Nate and Conor when they had the cops in between, and they used to do that for, like, Floyd fights and Tyson fights, and I always thought it was just, like, a gimmick for show, like, oh, these guys are so dangerous, we need to have police officers there with guns just to keep them apart, but turns out they actually serve a function.
Then, after that melee, we had the main event, where Stipe Miocic defended the UFC heavyweight title, defeating Alistair Overeem by knockout. It was in the first round, 4 minutes and 27 seconds in. Stipe got rocked early and knocked down by a good shot by Overeem. I want to say it was a right hand, but I could be off on that. Then he almost got guillotined, but came back, used his boxing, weathered the storm. And then throughout the fight, like the next, you know, 3 minutes, Overeem's literally running away from Miocic. Like worse than McGregor Diaz too, where McGregor was kind of walking away. There were times literally Overeem was running. But in the end, Miocic hit him with a couple good shots, got him down on the ground and just literally knocked him out on the ground. Overeem was out cold, kind of a vicious, knockout. Place went wild for Miocic, came off like a big star. Thoughts on that fight?
I thought that both guys basically fought the fight that they needed to fight. I thought that Overeem has developed a newer style lately, which is the kind of stick and move, don't get drawn into big exchanges, and it's worked for him in the past, you know, and it worked against Arlovski, it worked against Dos Santos.
Think that's more because you think that's because he thinks his chin is gone?
Yeah.
I mean, if he could still... Yeah, if he could still take a punch, I think he wouldn't change his style.
But he also, here's the thing, he never really did have a great chin. Chuck knocked him out at 205. Really, his legend grew because he was in K1 doing all this stuff, and that's when you have these gigantic boxing gloves. And those things make a huge difference when it comes to being able to protect yourself. Whereas in MMA, you have to develop completely different defenses. Most of your defense has to be positioning and footwork based with a little bit of head movement. Realistically, you know, again, Overeem, he's a middleweight, light heavyweight head on a heavyweight's body. And, and you know, I mean, did he run away? Yeah, I thought it was the right thing to do because he was resetting himself. You know, Miocic fought the way he needed to fight, which is the way he does, which is I press forward, I'm going to put pressure on you. I'm going to, you know, walk you down. I'm just going to throw punches at your head. I know you can't take me down. I'm big. I'm strong. I hit hard. And Overeem didn't want to get caught in the corner. And rather than I think that Overeem probably misjudged the distance a little bit at times. And that's why he was running as opposed to just sidestepping a lot. You know, again, he was a couple of inches away from finishing Miocic with that guillotine. And watching on TV, it happened way quicker because in person, that felt like forever with that guillotine. I was like, holy shit, he's dead. But he just, Overeem could not get his left leg through to block off that Miocic's right hip and keep him in position. That's what allowed Miocic to escape. Miocic, to his credit, escaped beautifully. It was weird the way it was finished because Overeem just kind of like slipped. Like, it was like, he kicked a little bit, and Miocic kind of half caught the kick, and Overeem just fell down, and Miocic got on top, and Overeem, he just covered up. He didn't try to grab the neck. He didn't try to break the posture, do any of the things you should have done. I mean, fucking CM Punk tried to break posture a little bit. Overeem just sat there, and, I mean, he got hit with ground and pound, and it was ground and pound that was just
like Fedor style almost.
Yeah, like you don't see guys get knocked out cold like that from ground to pound. You see guys get overwhelmed, but that was like, oh shit. And I can't remember who was refereeing that fight, but he did a really good job. I thought Overeem took some shots, and the moment he took like one or two shots, you could see him go limp. The referee immediately stopped it. And after that, and I wrote it in the live play-by-play, the single loudest reaction I've ever heard anywhere in any context in my life. I've been to rock concerts. I was there when, you know, Anderson Silva. I always thought Silva had just a huge reaction when he beat Dan Henderson. I've seen some of the greatest fighters ever get reaction. Nothing was like this. This was, I mean, I hate using the word deafening, but it was deafening. You could not hear anything. I could not hear anything except for this roar around me. And so much so that I'm really glad that Miosic won, because if he had lost, it legitimately could have been dangerous. Maybe not in the arena, but outside, because turns out the people in Ohio and Cleveland are not very attractive. Because I noticed that walking around. I'm like, hey, God, these are some fucking ugly people here. So, and they booed like crazy where I couldn't hear it after I lost. And if Miosic had lost, it would have been 100 times that. Instead, it was a reaction that, I wasn't like excited to go to the show. And my brother's like, hey, you know, it'd be historic. And it was. I saw CM Punk and that reaction.
I love everything about this show. It's so weird. There's weird ref things. There's freak show fights. There's some knockouts. It's just such a weird show. But when there's 50 shows a year, they can run and blend in together. This show, I'm not saying this in a good way, was special. It's just a special, different show that, you know, you'll remember UFC 203. You'll remember that number. You'll remember it was Punk. You might remember the broken finger. You might remember the big pop for Miocic. There's not a lot of shows where there's going to be three unique different things like that. I even like Betch Kohea, like, going off and acting like she won, you know, every medal in the Olympics. After the fight, Overeem in the post-fight interview with Joe Rogan claims he felt Miocic tap to this guillotine. Amazingly, Rogan, who claims he doesn't really even want to announce anymore. It's a pain in the ass. This might be like his first show since re-signing, because I think Rogan and Stan might have done the last Fox show. But he basically tells him in the truck, or however that works nowadays, to play it on the big screen. So on the big screen in the arena, they watch the scramble where Overeem gets Miocic in the guillotine. And, I mean, there was a little hand gesture where it looked like Miocic was trying to get a little wrist control, but it clearly wasn't a tap. Then Rogan goes, well, I didn't see it there. Let's look at another angle. It's like super slow motion. There's no tap. There's no tap anywhere. Miocic just rolls and gets out of it, and Overeem's just standing there, half concussed, just knocked out cold. With really no explanation. It was awkward yet hilarious at the same time, and another reason I love this show.
Yeah, and a lot of credit to Joe Rogan. I mean, again, I thought Rogan was on a different level than he's ever been on the show. Mm. His post-fights interviews, the one with Punk where he just basically said, this is really stupid. Why has this happened? Like, don't you think, basically embarrassed Punk by saying, what did you think? What were you thinking? Talking to Gall, weren't you kind of embarrassed by fighting this guy? Calling out Overeem a little bit. But, and then really to Rogan's credit, and I really, really respect him for this, when he said afterwards in some interviews about how he doesn't want to interview guys who've just been knocked out. And he's right, because, you know, Miosic thought that he got dropped by a kick and it was clearly a punch. He's not lying. He just doesn't know what happened. And the same goes for Overeem. Overeem very well may have thought he felt a tap. He doesn't know what's going on. I mean, the guy can barely figure out what's going on. And
he was knocked out. Like, he couldn't walk 3 minutes before that.
Yeah, I mean,
you know what I mean? It is crazy they do that. I mean, it's probably a judgment call in the cage. Like, oh, are you feeling all right? Can you talk to Rogan? And he's like, yeah, I'm all right.
But you can never trust the athletes. It's like in the NFL. Hey, are you concussed? No, I'm good.
Right. No, I'm not saying they should trust them.
Hey, Jimmy Rivera, can you see? Yeah, I can see now, not 3 minutes from now.
Yeah, no, I agree, and I think Rogan's right. You probably shouldn't interview him because they might say something stupid that they'll regret later, and they're not they don't have their full mental faculties at the time. So I'm with you and Joe Rogan on that.
And one other thing to address is Ira Helwani was very critical of Joe Rogan.
I saw some of that.
He basically ripped into Rogan because Rogan gave Punk a lot of shit. And he basically, and Helwani pulled the, well, Rogan, you've never fought, so what can you say card? And I'm like, I hate that. It's the stupidest argument. Joe Rogan is a legitimate black belt in jiu-jitsu. He has competed in taekwondo tournaments. He was like the Massachusetts State Taekwondo champion, whatever the fuck that means back in the day. But, you know, Joe Rogan knows as much as about MMA as almost anybody alive. And I thought that everything he said was accurate. I thought that he was basically had the balls to go out there and say something. And for Helwani, of all people, Mr. You know, I'm Edward R. Murrow of MMA, and I named my son after, I think, whoever it was, named his kid after, claimed his kid was named after one of the fucking famous journalists. Maybe it was Murrow, I don't know. It's like, that's what we should see. Rogan is out there, and he's not towing the company line. He's not building it up and saying how great it was. He's like, guys, this is really stupid. Why do we let this happen? Holy shit. Like, that's really cool. You've got all the respect in the world to Joe Rogan for, again, being the most honest man in all of MMA, it seems, because there are very, very few guys who would be commentating for the UFC, have that kind of position, and say something like that publicly and not give a shit. But Joe Rogan, because he has so much else in life, he has the ability to do that, and it's going to be a shame if, you know, when he ever does leave, and I'm glad that he's sticking around for just, you know, major North American pay-per-views so we can at least get him doing that. But, you know, Brian Stann ain't going to go out there and just criticize people left and right, and that's boring. I want to hear guys be honest.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think Helwani's point was that it kind of spoiled the fight, which I don't agree with. I still enjoyed that fight. I don't know what that says about me, but who would you like to see Miocic fight next? I mean, Werdum was campaigning for it, but he didn't look great. Kane is obviously in the mix coming off that big win, a much more impressive win over Travis Brown. And John Jones is making a little bit of noise, unusual, that he'd be up for fighting Miocic. Who do you see him fighting next, or who would you like to see him fight next?
There's not like a really good answer. Velasquez has clearly looked the most impressive of all the guys recently. It's really just Velasquez and Verdum. Josh Barnett just won, but he's kind of low. I can't even think who else is in the top five at heavyweight right now. Overeem just lost. Verdum, Velasquez, Brown probably was up there. Because it's kind of a thin division.
Junior Dos Santos.
Oh, yeah, Dos Santos.
I'd love to see Velasquez and Miocic. I think they're the two best guys in the division. I know Kane's always hurt, and people, I don't know, he doesn't get a lot of respect at all. Just based on that Werdum loss and that because he's always injured. Like, I get that. But Kane healthy, I think, is the best heavyweight of all time.
Yeah.
And Miocic is hot right now. He looks good. They're a similar style. It's a lot of wrestle, boxer sort of thing going on with both of them. And I think they're both well-rounded and good everywhere. If it were me, I might do Werdum versus Barnett or something.
I was going to say that exact same thing. I would have I think I would go with Velasquez and Miocic because, like you said, I think that they are the two best heavyweights, and that to me has a big fight feel.
Yeah,
and you have Werdum and Barnett on the undercard because odds are Velasquez is going to get injured, and that's really the big knock against him is that he gets injured. And otherwise, I don't know off the top of my head if Dos Santos and Arlovsky have ever fought. If they haven't, they should definitely fight.
They could still do, they never, unless I'm forgetting it, did Dos Santos and Overeem ever fight? Weren't they supposed to fight, like, a bunch of times?
Yeah, Overeem knocked him out.
That's
what got him this fight. Right. I mean, gotcha. I'd love to see Mark Hunt get in there, but who knows what the hell is going to happen with that. So, But yeah, I mean, Barnett, Verdum, because Verdum, yeah, he won and he was the champion and he looked really good in his run there. But and the only real argument I would have for doing Verdum first is simply if Miocic beats Verdum, then you have Miocic versus Velasquez, and then you have like history in the line, because if Miocic beats Velasquez, he's the greatest heavyweight ever. He'll have had the most successful title defenses. And Velasquez, along with a lot of other guys, currently is tied and holds that record as well. So there's kind of a neat story there. But again, I think Velasquez, just because what he did to Travis Brown, remember, he just fought Travis Brown as did
July.
Yeah. And oh, Ben Rothwell's also up there too. And we saw what Verdum did with Brown. We saw what Velasquez did. And Velasquez ran through him in that way where you realize, oh, yeah, you are, when healthy, the most dominant heavyweight probably who's ever lived.
Yeah, I don't think he gets the credit he deserves because he hasn't fought a lot. He fought all the same guys, you know, JDS and Bigfoot. There's some knocks on him. I get the argument against him. But it's like when you watch him and he's healthy and in his prime, he's unreal. A couple quick news bits, and we'll move onto this weekend. Robbie Lawler was scheduled to fight Donald Cerrone at UFC 205. Lawler pulled out of that fight. There was talk about Nick Diaz being a possible replacement, but he's refusing to pay a fine, a $75,000 fine from the Nevada State Athletic Commission. So he's still on the back burner, I guess. So today they announced that Kelvin Gastelum is going to be stepping in for Robbie Lawler, which is probably one of the more disappointing fight announcements I've heard in a long time.
Oh, that's like finding out that you just won a dream date with Kate Upton, and then at the last moment, like, oh, sorry, she's not available, but your high school French teacher is. It's God damn, man.
Yeah. And it's weird because they pulled Gastelum from a fight with, I can't remember who. I can't think of the guy's name. He fought Benson. It doesn't matter. Either way, they pulled him from another fight.
Brandon Thatch?
No. The guy who used to fight in the backyards with Kimbo. I forget his name every time. I did this last time, too.
Jorge Masvidal.
Thank you. Yeah, he was supposed to fight Masvidal.
Fuck, and I'd rather see Masvidal in Cerrone.
Me too. Gastelum, like,
I think Kelvin's from that. I feel like he's from New York.
I don't know where he's from. He usually fights on the Mexico cards, well, though, right?
He is Hispanic, but I think, yeah, he's quote unquote Hispanic. But he's right. Hispanic, like Velasquez is Hispanic.
Like he grew up in the States, you mean?
Yeah, and like I think he speaks more Spanish than Velasquez does.
I just pulled up his info. I mean, the first thing I'm laughing at is that he's 24. That's disturbing. But they say one of his other names is Mini Kane. I've never heard anyone call him that ever. But yeah, that's what they're saying to me. That's a lousy fight.
It's a fight in the sense of Kelvin has looked really good at times in his career. He's also missed a lot of weight and looked like crap.
I mean, he's ranked sixth in the UFC welterweight rankings now, so it's a step up for Cerrone in competition, but it doesn't scream fight of the year. It screams, you know, Gastelum trying to take him down and bully him up against the cage.
Yeah, in a New York City, I mean, to me, that Madison Square Garden show, you want to have as many action-packed, badass fights you can. I mean, Robbie Lawler and Cerrone was the most perfect fight they could have ever had.
Cerrone and Nick would have been awesome too. I was looking more forward to that fight happening than the Lawler fight. But I mean, that's just me. But yeah, Gastelum's definitely a step down.
Yeah,
name just, value,
quality,
you know,
of fight, it, all of it.
Yeah, all of it.
There's nothing about. I mean, Kelvin has a place, but he's going to be one of those guys that gets over by winning a lot, not by being exciting. I mean, God, look, it's Donald Cerrone. The dude legitimately did text Dana White and say, CB's hurt, I'll fight at light heavyweight on 3 hours' notice. And he would have done it, too.
Yeah, I know.
And he probably would have won.
He's amazing. He's really amazing. Right now I'm looking at the UFC rankings on UFC.com. He's Cerrone's ranked 6th as a lightweight and 7th as a welterweight right now. I don't think there's ever been a guy ranked in two divisions that high at the same time.
Not since they've had official rank. I mean, obviously when BJ Penn won the welterweight title, he was a top 2 or 3 lightweight. Usually guys don't get ranked in two divisions. Usually once you have a division, but you're down Cerrone. You don't have a division. You have a Cerrone weight. It's just, whatever people want to fight at. Yeah, you want me to make 155 in 3 days? I got 20 pounds. I'll make it. Like, he's just a madman.
Yeah, this tells me a couple other things, though. It tells me they've probably got a fight lined up for Conor, and it's probably Eddie Alvarez. Because Cerrone was asking for Eddie Alvarez after his last win. So I don't see him going Khabib in Alvarez. I'm thinking they might be leaning towards Conor and Eddie. And then obviously they've got something in the works for Woodley and maybe Stephen Thompson. They're going to go in that direction because Stephen Thompson versus Cowboy would have been at MSG would have been a sick fight too.
Yeah.
And they obviously didn't go that direction.
That's the best result would have been either one of the Diaz brothers. Nate, they would have had a really good rematch with Nate. Nick, I mean, if Nick's genuinely just not going to pay the fine on principle, it's so awesome, and it's just more of Nick being a hero that he is in life. If I'm the UFC, I'm just like, all right, we'll pay it. It's $75,000. The dude's worth a lot more than that.
Right.
I mean, goddamn, Nick Diaz versus Donald Cerrone, that would have been amazing. Holy shit. Instead, we get fucking Kelvin Gastelum. I could not. Goddamn, talk about. That's a roller coaster there.
Although, if Cerrone wins that, like Gastelum comes in overweight and Cerrone wins that fight, it's going to be a good pop in that building, man.
Oh, yeah. But it's still. Here's the thing, it doesn't really do much for Cerrone because nobody gives a shit about Gastelum. If he wins, yes, it helps because it'll be his 4th fucking win this year at welterweight, which that's got to be a record. But there's still Damian Maia in front of him. I mean, him and Damian Maia would have been some, although Maia, I think, said, I'm going to wait for my title shot, which he's earned his title shot. Fuck, they should have done Donald Cerrone and Carlos Condit.
Yeah, if Condit's up for it. But, I mean, they're fighting both out of Jackson Wink. They're probably, like, best. I don't want to say BFF.
Donald Cerrone would fight his mother or his grandmother for fun. And you know he would, too. He'd be like, yeah, whatever, boy. Let's just throw down and have some fun. Like, him and Leonard Garcia are, like, best friends. They just beat each other up in the gym all day.
Yeah, yeah. One more quick news bit. Olympic gold medalist Kyle Snyder sent out a tweet during UFC 203. I don't know if you saw this, he wrote, I want to fight at UFC. I'm not sure if that means he wants to fight UFC or if he wants to fight in the UFC or how to decipher that tweet.
Yeah.
But he's putting it out there that he's interested in getting into MMA. And the guy is 20 years old. He's the youngest American Olympic champion ever in the history of, American wrestling. He fights at,
small heavyweight. He's around the 212 range, I think 211 in the Olympics.
Yeah, he fought at 213 in the Olympics. But he's saying he wants to continue doing the amateur wrestling and MMA simultaneously. So you would think he'd be a light heavyweight probably, cut a couple pounds and fight at 205. Obviously he might grow over time. He's only 20 and he could end up being, a medium sized heavyweight down the road. But, it's kind of a big news story, and it'll be interesting to see. Obviously the UFC is not going to want to let him get away. But that'd be another case of, an O&O guy coming into the company. Obviously, it's a much different circumstance, clearly. But it's interesting because even guys like that, they don't often sign them unless they're trying to keep them from Bellator or something like that.
Like that Russian dude.
Yeah. But then you look at sometimes Bellator sneaks in and, they sign Aaron Pico.
Bubba Jenkins, they signed.
Yeah. And Jenkins, he's been a little bit of a wash so far, yeah. But it's interesting. The guy's young and he's the best wrestler in the world, the best amateur wrestler in the world. So I'll be curious to see, you know, what if he starts training, when he starts, and where he's training out of. It'll be an interesting story to see develop.
Yeah, if I had to guess where he would train, it would be Grudge Elevation there in Colorado, because the U.S. Olympic facility is in Colorado, and a lot of those guys do cross train. I mean, what's really amazing about him is obviously he won a gold medal at freestyle, and what we think of as college, as wrestling in college, is not freestyle. Freestyle is simply about a pin and, I'm sorry, a takedown and sometimes a pin. That's it. There is nothing else to it. Whereas folk style has, yes, takedowns, but also has a lot of controlling somebody, riding them. It actually translates much better to MMA than freestyle does. And this is a guy who, in his first 3 years of college, went 197-0 with 3 national championships. I think he placed second in another year. He also won the world championships at the junior level, and he was competing in freestyle and amateur wrestling at the same time for Ohio State. Like, he would be training for the Olympics, and then he would not actually wrestle folk style at all until the only time he wrestled was the start of the NCAA tournament. So he didn't have any scouting. Most of these guys wrestle each other throughout the year. They have a little bit of a feel for the guy. They know who they're going against. He just stepped into these tournaments and was dominating. I'm sorry, the 197-0, I think, was more than just college. But, I mean, he is that scary level wrestler. Of course, a word of caution. Henry Cejudo was 2021-ish when he won his gold medal also. And, you know, it doesn't always translate. But Kyle Snyder, he's a big old strong dude. He's a guy that in college tends to wrestle at heavyweight. He's always kind of got that Kurt Angle level of wrestling ability. So, yeah, if you ever want a pedigree to start with for a guy, it's always a high level amateur wrestler, and he's as high level as you'll ever get. Can he do both at the same time? No, nobody ever really has in modern MMA. And I don't think it can be done. It's just too much everywhere. You can't, you got to focus on one thing, but God damn, he could go out and win the next Olympics and be 24. And still,
right.
I mean, God, he'd only be Mickey Gall's age.
Right. Yeah, he's unbelievable. I'm looking forward to see what ends up happening. And if you think about it, if anybody could do it, do both, maybe it's him. You know, I mean, there you know, are special circumstances. What he said was interesting. This is a quote from Fox Sports. I want to pursue my wrestling career, wrestle in world championships and the Olympic Games. But if the scheduling could work out and I can become an elite fighter, then I want to fight in the UFC as well. I'm guessing they'll give him a pretty good,
he'll get a good 500. Bonus. Yeah.
Yeah, he'll get 500 grand to fight. So then this weekend we've got two shows. There's a Bellator show Friday night.
There is?
From a place. Huh. Yeah, what's wrong with you? What kind of journalist are you? Bellator, Cedar Park, Texas, Friday night, September 16th. What kind of op-ed columnist are you?
An exhausted one after last week. I'm so tired.
All right, we're going to go quick. We've got Chick Congo versus Tony Johnson in the main event. I can't believe you haven't heard about this.
I can't believe that both UFC and Bellator are in Texas.
Yeah, go big.
UFC's in Hidalgo, wherever the fuck that is.
No one cares. Nobody cares about this Bellator show. Joe Warren's on it.
Yeah, okay.
Then we've got their version of Paige Van Zandt, Anastasia Yankova, also fighting out of Russia.
Oh, okay.
And
it's something to do and kill time on a Friday night.
Yes. I'll probably fall asleep. Then the following night, Saturday the 17th, we've got a fight night show on FS1. Dustin Poirier versus Michael Johnson is the headliner. This one's taking place from Hidalgo, Texas, like you mentioned, State Farm Arena. a few good fights on the show. I mean, for a free fight night show, it's not the worst. It's not the best. You've got Poirier versus Michael Johnson, Uriah Hall versus Derek Brunson, Rick Glenn coming in on short notice to fight Evan Dunham. You know, besides that, it's a lot of, you know, fighters from Mexico on the undercard, not a lot of big names, but the main card's solid. You know, Poirier and Johnson's two, you know, top 10 ranked, lightweights. Poirier's obviously on the rise. He's hot right now. After coming up from featherweight, he's won four straight at lightweight. Not a lot of big names, but he's beat Bobby Green, Joseph Duffy, and Yancy Medeiros, and he's looked good doing it. Pretty dominant in all those fights. A lot of KO wins mixed in, so he's looked good since the McGregor loss, and seems, you know, to have more power at 155 than he did at 145. He's said for a long time that weight cut was killing him. All he could focus on was his diet and not eating, as opposed to training and being healthy, which he feels he is now. Versus Johnson, who I think is coming off a loss.
His last fight was Nate Diaz.
Was it Diaz? Yeah. So a big fight for Johnson. If he wants to stay relevant and in the mix, he's coming off actually two straight losses. He lost to Dariush by a split decision back in 2015. So kind of an important fight where, you know, the Poirier and Johnson are still kind of one or two fights away from being, you know, a real top contender in that lightweight division. So, personally, I like Poirier in the fight. He's been hot and on a hot streak lately, as opposed to Johnson, who's coming off two straight losses and hasn't fought since December of 2015.
Yeah, Johnson's kind of a weird case because he had like a really long win streak and was very against a very good competition. Something like five or six wins in a row. He's kind of on the verge of a title shot. He's taken a step back. I actually really like Benil Dariush. It was a close fight. Nate, he got beat, but he held his own in there. But Poirier has absolutely looked spectacular at 155 pounds. He's had some really good matchups at that weight. He hasn't had to take on, you know, a Khabib type. And Johnson does have good wrestling. But over five rounds, I think that it favors Poirier. Johnson, despite having some wrestling, tends to stand. Tends to be more of a boxer than anything. Poirier, much more versatile striker. And I like Poirier's chances of winning here. You know, all things being equal, I don't know if anybody's injured, blah, 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 blah. But, I think this is a really good fight, and I'm glad that it's five rounds. And I have a feeling when it's over, anybody who watches it won't be disappointed.
Yeah, co-main is Derek Brunson versus Uriah Hall. Brunson's another guy who isn't getting a lot of press, but is on a bit of a run himself. He's actually 6-1 in the UFC. His only loss is against Yoel Romero. And he's won four straight, the last three by TKO.
He beat somebody really good, too.
Carnero.
Madison,
someone else. Yeah, Sam Alvey, Ed Herman, and the Lance Larkin.
It was Sam Alvey I was thinking of.
Yeah, that was over a year ago. But he's on a little bit of a run. And then you've got Uriah Hall, who's so hit or miss. You never know what you're going to get with him. One day he looks like a killer. The next time he's passive, fighting like Jessica Eye. It's hard to say what you're going to get from him. He's coming off a decision loss to Robert Whittaker, another guy in the division that doesn't get a lot of hype. That's a different story for a different day, though. I don't know. I would pick Brunson, but that's just me.
Yeah, I'm picking Brunson. Just if for no other reason than it's always easy to bet against Uriah Hall. The guy, like you said, he's the definition of hit or miss. Yeah, he had the really big, awesome win over Gaethje Musasi. That was also a fight that he was losing until he landed basically one of the most spectacular knockouts you're going to see. All credit to him. He wanted to throw the kick. He wanted to hit the man with a kick. He did it, and he knocked the man out. That's great, but it wasn't really, you know, it was one like he went out there and dominated. And he fights like a point fighter, but the guy doesn't need to. He's someone that has such powers. His fast twitch muscles are a thing of beauty, and yet he just, there's a mental hiccup or something. I don't think he's a fighter. He's a martial artist. Good for him. He's a nice guy, but he doesn't have a killer instinct, and he desperately needs it. I think he loses his fight because he gets drawn into, I think he loses by decision, but I don't think that, I think Brunson can just win rounds. Hall is somebody that you can win rounds against because he'll just give away rounds.
Yeah, he's just, I always think of him as just being too passive, and every once in a while he'll hit, you know, a crazy kick or something and get a win, but he doesn't do it enough, and it's just a lack of aggression on his part. Anything else on the undercard you're looking forward to?
There was, let me pull it up real quick. There's no iOS, not the 10 is screwing with me, because I'm so used to having a slide to open things, and you don't have to do that anymore.
I haven't even downloaded it yet because I have no memory on my phone.
I did it last night. Evan Dunham and Rick Lynn should be pretty good. Evan Dunham, these guys fight. They're like identical fighters. Rick Lynn usually fought at 145. He was a World Series of Fighting champion at 45. Trained at Rufus Fort for years. I rolled with him quite a bit, actually. I could just see him improving. Like every month I'd go up there and be like, oh, this guy's gotten better. Like, he really put the work in. He's not a really great athlete. He's tough. He's a scrapper, just like Evan Dunham. But Evan Dunham's a bigger guy. I think Dunham's one of those guys that's mastered the art of scrapping fights out. And I think he's just going to outwork Glenn. Glenn's coming in on short notice. He's a late replacement. Actually, I don't think the fight's going to be very good. I say all that, like, it's kind of like, oh yeah, I know one of those guys, the other guy, their names, but I don't think it'll be exciting, but it's something to watch. Otherwise, I don't know, it's a fight night. Maybe it'll end up like Germany, or maybe it'll end up like some of the other random shows that turn out to be great.
Yeah, we'll hope for the latter. Other than that, that's all I've got. We went longer than we wanted, but I think UFC...
Not too much. Well, yeah, we went a half hour over.
UFC 203 is a special case. That's unusual show in a lot of different ways. Anything else to look forward to on the site this week? What else is going on?
Nothing. I wrote my one column. It was up today about being offended, and I don't know. This shit goes up on Thursday, and I don't know. We'll just coast through it. And
all right. Did were people offended by your offended article?
No, I got lots of positive reactions to it. Which
good.
Damn it. Well, everybody, that's the show here at AFGuarded.com. I'm Mike Coffin, and Grady will say goodbye as always, and that's the end of this shit show.
All right, we'll see you next week.
Aggressively, we all defend the role we play. Regrettably, times come to send you on your way. We've seen it all, bonfires of trust, flash floods of pain. It doesn't really matter, don't you worry, it'll all work out. No, it doesn't even matter, don't you worry, that ain't what it's all about. We hope you enjoy.